Welcome back, Question Medicine 2018. I am Andrew Bill down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida, and I think I have a gem for you. I think I have a whole bunch of articles I need to talk about and not enough time to talk about them. So without further ado, without any hesitation, reservation, I'm going to get this thing cranking. I got a little special treat for you at the end. Let's do this thing without any further hesitation, reservation. It is good to be back. All right, so many articles, so little time. And like I said, I'm going to throw in a new thing, I'm working on. Many, many avenues of which this last piece will be. I'm going to break down a drug that you're going to see from a drug rep in your office. And I'm going to tell you about it, tell you what I think it actually says, not what the drug rep wants me to tell you that it says. Because, again, I am never... not ever, not even once, sponsored by a drug rep. Although in residency, I did go to one drug rep dinner. But enough with that. On to the medical literature, shall we? Now, one of my favorite football quotes of all time, and it goes back long, long, long ago, but it still pops up every single year. It's the Dennis Green quote, where he's going nuts in a post-game interview, and he says, "They are what we thought they were, and we let them off the hook." Well, this next paper kind of could fall under that whole title of "We Are What They Thought They Were." This looked at performance-enhancing supplements used by athletes. This was in JAMA. It was in a paper titled "Chemical Composition and Labeling of Substances Marked as Selective Androgen Receptor Modulators and Sold Via the Internet," the intrawebs, if you will. And they did exactly that. They went on the intrawebs. They looked for these performance-enhancing anabolic steroids. What they were specifically looking for were the selective androgen receptor modulators, or the SARMs, and they were looking to see what's going on, because these are not approved by the FDA and are associated with serious safety concerns. They overall ordered 44 products off the internet, and when they went through it, 23 of these products, so over half, contained some sort of this SARM, or selective androgen receptor modulators. 18 of the products contained compounds listed on the labels in the specific amounts, which is really good. But 11 of the products contained the compounds listed, but not in the amounts specified. 3 of the products contained the compound listed, as well as some other just nebulous compounds that weren't listed. And 8 contained other active substances. I think the big take home here is if you have an active patient population, like a very active patient population, or even just an active patient that comes in and they're maybe a bodybuilder, it's to make sure that they're getting their supplements, they're getting their performance enhancing pills and shakes and whatever it may be from a reputable source, ideally even a store. But even then, we know it's all not perfect, is that there's no real serious clear FDA regulations on a lot of these things. But if you're getting it via the internet, well, about half of them are not what we thought they were. And speaking of not being who we thought they were, or maybe actually being who we thought they were, the next paper also comes from JAMA. The Effects of Tamsulosin on Passage of Symptomatic Urinal Stones. This is June 18, 2018. And this trial either confirmed your bias or confirmed your bias, and it really confirmed your bias no matter what you did. If you believe that Tamsulosin actually works for kidney stones, then you looked at this trial and you said, well, I mean, this trial didn't show it, but other ones have. And if you believe that Tamsulosin didn't work for kidney stones, then you said, well, see, there it is, another trial that shows, look at there, it doesn't actually work for kidney stones. We could debate ins and outs, the ups and downs of if it actually works and what's this proposed mechanism and how it works on the ureter to cause relaxation and all this Ivy League stuff. But I think overwhelmingly now we have enough data to say that it doesn't really work. And if you have multiple trials that say it doesn't work, but you have a few trials that say, meh, maybe it does work, then we have to ask ourselves, does it really work? Because if it really worked, it should work all the time. This is a lot like vitamin D, and this is the best way for me to reference it, is that it's not that, oh, it seems that exactly 1,152 milligrams taken at 2 o'clock in the afternoon is exactly what works. Or it's the tamsulosin works for a 7-millimeter stone, but not for the 6.5-millimeter stone because there's something different about... No. It probably doesn't work. And I heard it on the Broom Docs podcast, and it was just a great explanation. But if you have a drug early on, you're going to have small trials. Small trials are notorious for having positive outcomes, only because they're small, but there's usually some kind of bias involved in them. And if it's a negative trial, it usually doesn't get published. So we have these small trials to begin with that show a positive effect of a drug. Then, as we develop and as we process, we get bigger randomized controlled trials, and then those do not show benefit. I think it's when those larger trials do not show benefit that that's what we need to go with. We need to go when the tide takes us in, we need to go in. And when the tide takes us back out, we need to go back out. I am sure there are many things that we do in medicine right now that we only have small trials for. But in the future, when we have larger trials, good randomized trials, and they don't work, I won't be surprised. And when they don't work, I'll be stopping using them in my practice, and I think that you should stop using them in your practice, similar to tamsulosin for kidney stones. Now, this next little part I like to call a little bit of a rant. A little bit of a rant about the IVC filter. And I don't think I've actually ever talked about IVC filters before on Questioning Medicine, although I should. I certainly should talk about them at some point because they tend to be more harm than good. In fact, there was a study published in Circulation 2016 titled Outcomes for Vena Cava Filter Use in Non-Cancer Patients with Acute Venous Thromboembolism, a population-based study, and a quote right from that study that I love so much. In all subgroups, filter use did not reduce the risk of subsequent pulmonary embolism. Yep, you put a filter in, you think, oh, this will be great, I'm going to stop the pulmonary embolism, that'll be awesome. Oh no, you actually probably won't. You might in the short term, there is no doubt. In the short term, you probably will. You'll decrease the rate of pulmonary embolism about 2 to 4% in the immediate aftermath. However, when you're looking and you're following these patients for months out or even a year out, no difference. No difference at all. And I think that is an important take-home question. And then, not only is there no difference, you gotta remember, the IVC filter is not a benign thing. It can break off, it can cause all kinds of thrombophlebitis, and it can be nasty. When the benefits and the harms are equal, we have to look and say, is this really even beneficial? In the short term, in the first week, 2 weeks, I think we can say, oh yeah, it's probably beneficial. After that, I think we have to start questioning medicine. And you see, there it is, to an end. Not very long rant, just an appropriate amount. And a reminder that really you should only be putting an IVC filter in if there is an absolute contraindication to anticoagulation. And with that, how about an absolute contraindication to the knowledge bomb of life? And that is, I think, maybe the knowledge bomb of this podcast, Annals Internal Medicine Brief Commentary. The laboratory accuracy of hemoglobin A1C ranges and treatment targets for patients with type 2 diabetes. This is awesome. And to go ahead and quote from this one, the National Glycohemoglobin Standardization Program, yes, that's a thing, works to decrease the variability within and among clinical laboratories. Despite major advances, sequential hemoglobin A1C values within 0.5% do not statistically differ. What does that mean? It means that if you give a drug and A1C goes down by 0.4, you can't for sure say that the medication did anything at all because the error of the test is 0.5. So if you don't get outside the error of the test, there's really only one way to know if it actually was any good, and that is to run that same test somewhere in the range of 1,000 to 10,000 times and then plot it out on a graph and figure out how much they actually moved or how much their A1C moved. Now, we know that's ridiculous, but in studies, they can do that. They have enough points, enough data points, that they can plot it out and figure out roughly how much of a drop in the A1C you can expect. That is not the case for the patient sitting in front of you. So there you go. There it is. It's not the lab error. It's just a standard of range of which we accept for diabetes. All right. When we have patients in the hospital, I often think that sometimes we do the most ridiculous things ever. We scan and give drugs that probably don't need to be given. We put patients in isolation when they probably don't need isolation. And we give neutropenic diets when they don't need neutropenic diets. This, of course, is choosing wisely. Things we do for no reason. Things we do for no reason is a neutropenic diet. Oh yes, oh yes. It has been a myth that's been around and keeps being put around and around. Randomized trials have shown that these restrictive neutropenic diets, which limit your fresh fruits and vegetables, they're very restrictive. They limit your amount of dairy, your meats. They're very not tolerable by the patients, just for the simple fact that you don't have many options and they just don't taste very good. They have shown that these restrictive diets, these neutropenic diets, are not superior in preventing infections than the more liberal diets. And the FDA already has standards by which kitchens have to follow in order to prepare food. So if they are following the standards, which they already are, in how to prepare and handle the food, then I'm going to go ahead and say it. Here's the bottom line. Thus, routine use of neutropenic diets should be abandoned. And that's enough of that. Now, there's one thing I know. If there's one thing I know for absolute, certainly sure, it's that every board test will have some sort of question about Barrett's esophagus, yet not every patient that has Barrett's esophagus will develop esophageal adenocarcinoma. Although, every board test, every patient always gets esophageal adenocarcinoma. Well, here we go. A paper in Gut, Cancer Incidence, the Incidence and Mortality Risk in Large U.S. Barrett's Esophagus Cohort. Now, we know that Barrett's esophagus increases the risk of esophageal adenocarcinoma somewhere in the range of 10 to 50 times that of the general population. However, if your risk of zero is zero, and it's 50 times greater risk, but your risk is zero of developing it, well then, it's still zero. I mean, my risk of being pregnant is zero. So even if I took a medication that increased my risk of becoming pregnant by 600 times, my risk would still be zero. This study looked at the Kaiser Permanente, Northern California, and they looked at over almost 9,000 patients, provided over 50,000 person years with follow-up, and those individuals with Barrett's esophagus had increased risk of esophageal adenocarcinoma, almost 24 times more likely. And the risk of developing esophageal adenocarcinoma decreased with time, or the time from which you were diagnosed with a Barrett's esophagus. However, esophageal cancer mortality did not, indicating that there is a true risk, and that risk is stable and persistent over time. However, your risk of actually developing esophageal carcinoma is still pretty rare. What kind of numbers are we looking at here? For every 420 patients with Barrett's esophagus, one of those patients will develop cancer each year. This next study should fall into the category of, well, I told you so, because it is titled The Effect of Screening with Primary Cervical HPV Testing versus Cytology, Testing on High-Grade Cervical Intraepithelial Neoplasia at 48 months, also known as CIN. At 48 months, the HPV Focal, that's the name of the trial, randomized clinical trial. Whew, that is a mouthful, but it gets to one easy take-home point, and that is that Questioning Medicine nails it again for the win. What do I mean by that? Well, let's dig into the details. This study was designed specifically to examine if HPV testing as a primary screening modality was equal to cytology. And like we said before, it is. We know that it is. We know that it is, but it hasn't quite been done like this before in a study. The women were assigned in a one-to-one ratio to either have cytology, HPV. They looked to see what were the initial rates of colposcopy, what were the final rates of colposcopy, And the test did exactly what we wanted. HPV found more CIN3s, found more abnormal exams, found more abnormalities earlier in the screening. And remember, when it's a screening test, we want to find it earlier because we want to find cancer earlier, but we don't want to have high rates of false positives because we don't want to be sending all these people to colposcopy. I think the authors summarize it best when they say, these results have demonstrated that primary HPV testing detects cervical neoplasia earlier and more accurately than cytology. It is overwhelmingly clear now that cytology likely adds little to the diagnosis of cervical cancer, at least for cervical cancer screening, but it certainly adds in cost. So what is the true benefit here? I'm only left wondering with a brush in my hand. And for one of my last studies here, I'm going to talk about the POINT trial. Yes, that's right. I'm pointing at the POINT trial. It was titled Clopidogrel and Aspirin in Acute Ischemic Stroke with High Risk TIA. This is the New England Journal of Medicine. And this was the POINT trial. This is now published after the CHANCE trial. A reminder is that the CHANCE trial looked at clopidogrel in high risk patients with acute non-disabling cerebral vascular events. And in that trial, there was a 32% lower risk of stroke reoccurrence among Chinese patients who were treated within 24 hours of a minor ischemic stroke, or TIA, with the combination of clopidogrel and aspirin, compared to those that were just treated with aspirin alone. And this was great, except for people were saying, wait a second, this was done in China. I don't work in China. This isn't good for me. So this was a randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trial from 10 countries, and get this, 82.8% of those patients enrolled in this study were from the United States of America. Patients were randomly assigned to receive 1-to-1 ratio of either clopidogrel plus aspirin or placebo plus aspirin. The primary outcome that they were looking for was a composite of ischemic stroke, myocardial infarction, or death from ischemic vascular causes within 90 days of the index event, and then the primary safety outcome was the risk of major hemorrhage. I think that these are all reasonable. We want to know what's the reoccurrence rate, and then if we're putting you on double antiplatelet, we want to know, are we making you bleed a lot more? Well, the dual platelet strategy experienced less major ischemic events, 5% versus 6.5% for aspirin alone. But with every up comes a down, with every in comes an out, when the door opens, it must shut again. So yes, those individuals who are on the dual antiplatelet therapy also suffered more major hemorrhage at a rate of 0.9% compared to 0.4% among the controls. Now that's really a difference of 0.5%. And the benefit was gained 1.5%. So ideally, you would like to say, well, we could just take the 1.5% and subtract 0.5%, and bada boom, bada bing, there you go. It leads to a net benefit of 1%. Except if you really want to be evidence-based about this, you can't do that. And the reason you can't do that is because you can't say that a non-fatal MI is the same as a intracranial bleed, which would be a major hemorrhage. You can't compare apples and oranges, so you can't subtract and add the benefits like that. But it'd be nice if you could. I think the authors really sum it up best in this study when they say, this is what you need to take home from it. This is where the shared decision-making needs to happen, because they say, for every 1,000 patients who are treated with a clopidogrel plus aspirin during a period of 90 days, such treatment would prevent approximately 15 ischemic events, but would cause 5 major hemorrhages. Now, I know the 5 major hemorrhages is scary. However, statistically speaking, there was no difference in the groups among the rates of hemorrhagic stroke, symptomatic intracranial hemorrhage, or other symptomatic intracranial hemorrhage. Meaning, these are major bleeds, likely GI or gut bleeds, but they're not brain bleeds. There's no major difference in the brain bleeds. But again, for every 1,000 patients, we are preventing 15 ischemic events. I think this is pretty cool. I think it's pretty important. And I think it's really going to be guideline and game changing now. I think that aspirin Plavix, this is ready ready to happen. I think that this is guideline changing. I think the HPV article I just talked about is also be guideline changing. They included patients down to 25 years old. Currently, we don't use, recommendations are not to use HPV testing for those individuals down to 25 years old. And I would even say in talking to my fiance about this is that really, if you're really looking at the evidence, and we're only going to be doing HPV, and right now we have evidence down to 25 years old, should we even be doing cytology up to 25 years old? If there's no symptoms, should we even be doing that? Because really, if you think about it, if cancer equals HPV, and we know that those younger than 25 typically clear the virus themselves. I mean, those over the age of 25 actually typically clear it as well. But under 25 will typically have it and clear it. Should we even be testing for it? And if we shouldn't be testing for that, then why are we even doing cytology when we know cytology is a not superior test? It's interesting. I don't know where medicine's going to go, but I can tell you, I think that based on these two studies, guidelines should change. All right, last but not least, I'm going to do something for the first time. I've never done it before. Write to me, tweet to me, let me know if you like this. And I might do it more in the future, but I'm trying to test it out and see how it would work. I guess. I'm going to talk about a drug. I'm going to kind of do a deep dive on a drug, but it's going to be a quick little deep dive. It's going to give you the ins and outs of what you actually need to know about the drug and not necessarily what the drug rep's going to tell you about the drug. The drug I'm talking about is Xhance. It is the old school drug, fluticasone, but it's with a new school device. This device is super nifty, handy, neat. You put one piece in your mouth and blow, and when you're blowing, it blows the particles through the device up into your nostrils, which is where there's a hole. So it's almost like an L shape, if you can imagine, you know, sucking on your thumb and then sticking what would be the L shape or the trigger of the gun into your nose, and then you blow on your thumb and the particles fly up into your nose. And it is a cool device. It's got a really neat selling point in the mechanism that the exhalation force the steroids deeper into the nose. It could kind of make sense, I guess. Well, they looked at close to 950 patients were randomized to placebo or different doses of this Xhance drug. And I always kind of find it interesting when they compare it to placebo. And they don't compare it to what is currently the community gold standard. They just compare it to placebo. Well, why not just compare it to the community gold standard? Anyways, it's intriguing. So that's what they did. The primary endpoints of their study were change from baseline to at 4 weeks in nasal congestion or obstruction. And the nasal congestion was rated by the patient on a 0 to 3 scale. They had another primary endpoint, which was the change from baseline to week 16 in bilateral polyp grade. And the polyp grade was determined by a clinician using a nasal endoscope. The mean change from baseline in nasal congestion at week 4 was 0.3 over placebo. Now, you gotta remember, this is on a 3-point scale, so it would be equal to saying, listen, my congestion is moderate to severe at 2.6 out of 3. But now that I've taken this new drug, well, now I'm at a 2 out of 3 compared to those suckers who just got placebo, and they are at 2.3 out of 3. Again, that's not a lot. And I get what they're doing here. You can make it statistically significant when you have that type of scale, but is that really clinically significant? 2.0 compared to 2.3? I'll let you be the judge. But remember, that was not the only outcome. The other was the polyp grade, which although it did appear to improve over placebo, it was a difference of about 0.5 to 0.6 difference than placebo. And again, that's equal to the physician saying, holy smokes, look at those polyps in there. Those things, those big old suckers, used to reach below the lower inferior border of the inferior turbinate. But now, oh no, not now. Now they've shrunk quite a bit. Now they're just above the inferior border of the inferior turbinate. Again, is that clinically significant? Is the patient in front of you breathing going to notice, oh man, my polyps, they've shrunk maybe a quarter of a millimeter. Oh, I feel so much better now. I don't know. I will let you be the judge. I personally have never had nasal polyps, but I can tell you in reading this study about this drug, I'm not super impressed yet, but I was super impressed when I went to GoodRx and I looked up the price. For GoodRx, in GoodRx app, down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida, we're looking at about $430 per prescription. Yet, we have zero evidence, because remember, it was compared to placebo, zero evidence that it works any better than what we're currently prescribing. Things like just general old fluticasone, budesonide, or mometasone. And while here on Question Medicine, I would never, ever, ever tell you what to prescribe, I can tell you that for me, there's zero chance, no chance, that I prescribe Xhance, this nasal polyp, nasal congestion, new medication. And there it is. There you have it. There's a little wrap-up on a new drug that drug reps are going to be bringing into your office. Let me know if you like it. If you like it, I can do more of them. If you don't, then I won't. I'll put a wrap on this episode. And with that, I will end this podcast like I have ended every podcast before it. Until next time, keep quest and questioning.